Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is Sarah Sands, who will be familiar to many listeners for having edited numerous publications, including Reader's Digest, The Sunday Telegraph, and The Evening Standard, before moving into radio to edit Today, BBC 4's flagship news programme. She's also found time to write several novels and continues to sit on or chair numerous boards. She's an honorary fellow of Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge, and Goldsmiths College, University of London, where she studied. Quite recently, however, she made the radical decision to abandon her formidable career in exchange for a quieter, more spiritual life, and has written three books about monasticism, faith, and inner peace. She also now organises pilgrimages. To use a very overused and hackneyed word, but one which applies to such a seeker, she's been on an extremely interesting and life-changing journey. Sarah Sands, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's lovely to have you. But before we talk about your recent books and pilgrimages, can we start at the beginning? What made you choose journalism?
I think looking back, I was quite interested in publishing, and I realised that I also had a sense of what a news story was, in that I would get very excited by something that happened suddenly, and was very good at passing on all sort of gossip and stories. So, you know, a horrible child. At the time, I was married to an actor, and who was in a film called The Killing Fields.
Julian Sands.
That's right, Julian yes. Sands, and which was about, he played a journalist called John Swain, who is still a very distinguished journalist on the Sunday Times. And when I met him and realised how interested I was in what he had done, and that the kind of approach that journalists have, which is more observational, less performative, I thought that that was really a career that I wanted to do.
But you were very good at it and had quite a meteoric rise. How do you explain that? Because it was quite a male world that you went into.
Well, it was just a buccaneering world. And I think I, in fact, one of the two of the editors who did just refer to me as a sort of honorary man. And I think I just enjoyed the mischief of it. And at the time, for that sort of generation of women, which is not at all exemplary in that we were very sort of heavy drinking and, you know, we played it like the men. But there was there was a sort of joy in succeeding and competing. And so, and competing over stories is just a very pure kind of competitive sport. And there's a kind of a mischief in that, because it's not just that you've succeeded, it's someone else has failed, as the saying goes. So I think I just sort of understood how news worked.
So at what point did you start to think, this is all a bit clamorous and hectic?
Well, very late on, actually. I think I was still clamoring away until I was about 60. And I think the move to the Today programme was because it actually was something new. I think that I sort of understood newspapers, and I didn't know about broadcasting. So I thought that was still looking for the new thing, which is always what journalists are doing. It was interesting and it was fun, but I could also start to see that that news wasn't quite the same as life. My friends are all journalists still. I love the instinct of journalism, of curiosity, but actually it can also be very sort of solipsistic. I was listening to Jonathan Sumption actually on Radio 3 the other day, saying that whenever he's been really involved in a case, he's always quite shocked by how ill-informed the coverage is. And so it's that thing first of it necessarily being, you know, simplistic, unless you're doing some, you know, fantastic 3-year investigation. The facts can all be right, but it sometimes lacks a sort of deeper truth. And I was, and I'm in particularly, I think the areas of nature and faith, I think, are the two which are the ones that news finds hardest to do. They can do nature if it's apocalyptic, and they can do faith if it, I was noticing even with the Pope, and you kind of think it's a really big news story. But the news coverage tends to be simply, you know, what did he say about Trump, and is he conservative or is he not? And then you see him come out and you think, oh no, it's about his holy, it's about his belief in God, all these things, which are very, very difficult to describe in news terms, but are a great part of life. I tried to do a perky little feature on a Saturday on the Today Programme called Nature Notes, which the only person who really liked it was John Humphreys, and then actually Martha Carney. Everyone else just loathed it. Just sort of, oh, it's about blackbirds. And I said, no, like, nature really matters to people. It's a huge part of people's lives and souls, and yet it's very, very difficult to cover it in news terms. So it was just a slight sort of waning of, I guess, of interest, that not everything had to be, you know, new and immediate and binary and apocalyptic, and just life could happen in a more sort of patient way elsewhere. So I think that was the sort of peeling off moment. And COVID actually was a big part of that. I think it happened to a lot of people.
And apart from anything else, you're doing, this is a program that goes out every single day, you know, 6 days a week, and for 3 hours a day live radio. I mean, how hectic was that? I mean, did you have a single second for your husband and family and children? And
No, not a second. Not a second. Because it is that thing of where your attention is. And so if you're looking at your phone the whole time, and there was a period actually quite early on where for some reason my phone got linked up to the taxi booking system for the news desk, and so actually all night it was just never stopped. And actually I remember going to see he was a friar in Oxford, and he had said, and he'd said, you know, politely had asked about the Today program, so I immediately started taking him through it, and he said, oh, I've never listened. And I said, oh. And he said, because I'm praying. So you could start your morning actually praying rather than being in this strange news bubble. And so I haven't had some fantastic spiritual conversion. I'm as bad a person as I ever was, but I do have an appreciation that there is life outside news.
Well, I beg to differ about you being as bad a person as you ever were, because your book, The Interior Silence, 10 Lessons from Monastic Life, what I really liked about it was how incredibly honest you are. And at one moment you use this very good thing, you say you've worked out the difference between joy and pleasure, which I thought was very interesting. And you were so funny about your creature, how hard it was to let go of your creature comforts. Trailing your pillow around all those.
Very hard. Yeah, the pillow. I think when it comes to it, that's going to be the red line, I think. You know, between, you know, do you get to heaven's gate? I'm not going to give up that pillow, I think.
So what was the first pilgrimage or equivalent or monastery you visited? Because you've been to a lot now.
I have been to a few. I mean, I've done it in quite a journalistic way, you know. So again, when and discussing it with journalist friends who first wondered if it was some kind of yoga retreat. I must say, I watched White Lotus with, you know, my sort of head in my hands, you know, thinking that is that me? And I don't know if you've seen it, but the sort
of daughter
who keeps saying she's looking for this sort of spiritual enlightenment. So my spiritual enlightenment was sort of was 2 or 3 days. And so there were no long proper stays, but it was enough to have an understanding of how there could be a different rhythm and a different way of looking at things. And I think probably started actually just that in my garden I'm looking out at now. I have this fragment of a a 13th century Cistercian nunnery, it was. And there is something about the shape of it and the silhouette and the jackdaws and the F-35s coming sort of whizzing over it actually shortly. But that speaks to something else. And then quite near here is the nunnery where Sister Wendy, who was a big television star for a time, so she was this nun on. So there were, you know, two famous nuns: there was Julie Andrews and there was Sister Wendy, and she would appear on discussion shows. She was on. She knew about art history, and so she was interviewed and. I remember, and then the interviewer said to her, "Gosh, what do your nuns think? Other nuns think of your incredibly exciting life and all the travel and being on telly all the time?" And she said, "Oh, they feel sorry for me." And it was such a lovely response. And again, I sort of under so I'm in a kind of strange foot in both camps of being able to. See what journalism looks like from the outside. While still, you know, they're still my pals. And so,
as a journalist, I think you have explained and articulated what it means to find a sort of alternative spiritual path better than anyone almost ever. You've made it so accessible that I think you'll get a lot of people very excited about doing it themselves now.
Oh, good. Well, hence, perhaps we could come to the British Pilgrimage Trust at this stage.
And can we just yes. take a step back? Because you had a pretty terrible year where, I hope you don't mind me talking about this, but you faced a lot of death in a year. So there was your father, your former husband, who disappeared in the Californian wilderness, later found dead there. And, of course, your beloved brother, whom I knew, Kit Hesketh Harvey, the glorious cabaret artist. And you wrote this wonderful book, The Hedgehog Diaries.
The Hedgehog Diaries was written after my father died, but before Kit and Julian died. There was this moment of a sort of symmetry when I'd found this hedgehog and I was trying to get it well over the winter months for spring. And as it happened, my father became quite ill during that time. So there was a kind of, both needed to put on weight, you know, both. So we talked about spring a lot. And then finally I went to pick up the hedgehog from its foster parents and release it into the wild. And that night was also the night that my dad died. And so I guess it had put me into a sort of more sort of thoughtful frame of mind about relationship between nature and relationships. Mm-hmm. And because my brother had been a chorister at a child chorister at Canterbury Cathedral, he was very, very good on the whole ceremony of basically weddings and funerals. He used to sing at them all. So he immediately knew, kicked in with my dad about, you know, what a vigil should be, what he'd wrote an anthem for it and so on. And so I'd been slightly becoming sort of accustomed to, a kind of ceremony of death. And then there was the sort of juxtaposition actually with Julian and Kit was that Julian had gone missing, had gone for a hike and had gone missing. And so there was a sort of search for him. And so we had a little service for him at my son's church, little church by his house. And so we were singing in rather a sort of wavery way, Onward Christian Soldiers, I think, because it was just the only thing we could play on the organ. And about halfway through, just suddenly my brother walked in and started singing. And because he was trained, you know, it sort of lifted everything. And I think we went into some really sort of rousing hymns after that. And then a week later, he was found dead. But still he had this amazing sort of voice that, you know, is how I kind of remember him singing during that service. Julian was most famous for the film Room with a View that he did, where, you know, he was the sort of young a romantic hero, but actually very like himself in that he was, you know, sort of passionate and sweet and slightly clumsy. And then the next film he was meant to have done was Morris, also by Forster.
Didn't your brother Kit write the screenplay for that?
Kit wrote the screenplay.
And Hugh Grant did it in the end.
That's right. Yeah. So it was then Hugh Grant and James Wilby sort of took it. So they were quite, so they'd known it, you know, they were, so the whole, I guess that period became one that they were quite, you know, entwined. So the memory of that, and actually there was a documentary of Merchant Ivory came out last year, which was dedicated to Kit. And so suddenly, you know, I'm remembering just the, well, the Puccini from Room with a View, you know, the theme tune. And and then, you know, Kit being part of that. And then, so actually the last thing I wrote was called Constellations and Constellations, which is really a sort of audiobook, so a way of getting in some of Kit's songs. But just that's more about the relationship between, you know, why choral singing and has this particularly, you know, life and death quality to it. And there was another connection, which was that my son's wife, who's from Estonia and is a great, has a very beautiful choral singing voice. And she and Kit became very sort of animated about, you know, they'd phone each other about, because she'd just discovered, you know, a talus or a bird, and what did he think? And so, so actually when it came to the funeral, you know, she knew exactly what he would have wanted, because they'd discussed all these were all their references. So I did a sort of trip across the Baltics on a kind of Hanseatic route, trading route, because Norfolk is very much on the Hanseatic route, with King's Lynn being a big, was a big trading port. So it was about sort of music and this trade route that was also a kind of pilgrimage. And so out of all that, there is now a merchant and pilgrim route across Norfolk, which goes from King's Lynn to Ely Cathedral and passes a lake where Kit was doing some conservation work. So that's our pilgrimage. I think 10 miles is a good walk.
Oh, that's enough for a day, yes.
That's enough for a day. So the whole lot, which my very long-suffering husband is going to do, the whole 70 miles. So that'll be a week, but later in the year. But we're going to do the last stretch. So it'll be a sort of group of us who are friends and family of Kit.
Going back to all the monasteries and so on that you visited, I mean, your husband Kim has been with you on quite a few of those trips, hasn't he? And the famous time he left his phone in your bag at the monastery.
It was a Trappist monastery, so there's no talking, so you certainly couldn't make phone calls. And so I really couldn't let him know, and there was nothing I could do. So I just thought, you know, it's good for us to have no phone for a couple of days. He had a rather different response.
Well, one of the things I really want to ask you is, I have no sense of direction at all. And a lot of what you write about is you're very on your own, and you're trying to find your way around these completely unmarked big monasteries, you know, and that door, and where do you go? And then there was one that you came outside and you couldn't work out how to get back down to it again. And do you have a sense of direction? Because you do an awful lot of, you're very brave. You just go off on your own and somehow trust you'll find your way back.
I don't have a great sense of direction. Actually, it was something Emma Bridgewater said about pilgrimages, is about losing yourself and finding yourself. It's a very nice way of putting it. You know, so I think sometimes it's not a bad thing not to quite know where you are or how you're going to get out of the situation.
Well, there are lots of kind of paradoxes, aren't there? There's a very lovely one you've got right at the end of your book about how silent is an anagram of listen.
Again, it's an interesting thing because journalists should listen and they do up at a point, but they're kind of waiting for an answer, aren't they? It's not the it's not sort of listening in any patient sense, I think.
When did you last do an in-depth interview as a journalist?
I haven't done any interviews for a while.
But I'm wondering if you were sent now to interview, I don't know, Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah.
Would you think the quality of your listening and the way you ask questions would have changed radically over, you know, from what it was, say, 3 years ago?
Yes, I think so. I might ask different kinds of questions. When you're doing a news interview, like for the Today programme, you know, I and other producers are sitting in the gallery. We're just waiting for a news line. So it's asked that, yes, got them. You know, yeah, that's going to work.
Yeah.
So on. So the idea that you could interview someone without wanting a news line is a new prospect. Though there was a good question. I remember John Humphreys asking, who I always thought was the most susceptible to nature and faith.
Yeah.
And he, I remember when Notre Dame burned down, and it was the former Archbishop of York, and he said, well, we're all praying. And John Humphreys said, oh, what are you praying for? And I thought, it's good, very good question. And rather through him, actually.
I think you should start interviewing all these world leaders, but in your way, in your new way. I think it'd be absolutely fascinating. And I'm just wondering, do you think, has your family noticed a great change in you? Do they ever, do they talk about it?
No, funnily enough. I think I am a bit more attentive.
You write in the book as well about the need to get rid of stuff because we all have too much stuff.
Yes, much too much stuff.
Yeah. Are you good at that or is that still...
But I don't like to acquire things much anymore except, you know, plants. But so the things that I would always think, like shopping actually slightly it bores me now in a way that, you know, was always the fun thing to do.
Clothes and shoes, you
mean? Clothes, just not not interested. Do you find that?
I mean, I think that's partly a twofold thing for me. One is age and one is cash.
But it was always something. I mean, I'll never turn down, you know, a face cream or a bath oil, the things, when I think now, what was so the waste of money on all those clothes and everything that we bought.
Yes, I know. Oh, can we just talk about Sound of Music for a minute, actually?
Oh, Sound of Music. You can do a Sound of Music tour. Oh, just imagine the bliss of it that you can go actually to the, you know, lake where they all fell in off the boat and the little glass house where she looks. And still, it's those... that look she gave him when they did the dancing, she puts her hands to her cheeks. Do you remember?
Yes.
And all the clothes. I mean, I've never known a better film, have you?
No, it's a brilliant, but you actually got into that, the nunnery.
Yes.
Where the children
nunnery.
Go looking for.
Exactly, where they say, we're looking for Maria.
What's it called? Nonnenberg.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what was that like?
As with some of the others, actually, the sense of a life within and apart, you know, has this enormous sort of dignity.
What's so interesting about what you're doing with your book and now your pilgrimages in Norfolk is you're sort of spreading the word.
I think what you'll find is that once you... once you become a little more accustomed to a different way of thinking about things and looking at things, then you'll find just patterns and coincidences. So the British Pilgrimage Trust that's just a sheer coincidence of the person who runs it. The founder is called Guy Hayward, and he was a chorister who then does a cabaret called Bounder and Cad with John Rutter's nephew,
gosh,
Adam and Guy. And so they had very much based it on Kit and the Widow. And so I met them at Kit's funeral And they said, you know, we've, you know, it's total sort of homage to. And then Guy said that when, before Kit had died, in the last months, he had become very interested in this pilgrim route of these churches that he, in Norfolk, that he felt were sort of neglected and rather beautiful. And for kind of sad reasons, he was living the vestry of the church in his opposite family home. So his idea was a simple one, rather brilliant, is if you just, you know, provided kind of lavatories, basically, in some of the vestries, people could, like, Airbnb or as it were, you know, and so you could get, you could do walks and stay there, and then the money would go to the churches, yeah, and you get a bit of footfall. Guy, I was talking to, and I then went on his, one of his walks, and there were people who, you know, I hadn't met before, but you just sort of fall into conversation, and at the end of it, you can't quite explain why, but it's you just feel sort of better. And it's so, but it's not like a, it's always sort of hard because people then immediately try and say, oh, nature and faith, it's mental health. And it's not, it's more than that. You know, it's not just a, it's a, you just feel a bit different. And I guess the nearest is a kind of, you know, a sort of peace of mind, which is a kind of, you know, you're just smiling at the end of the day. So what I would suggest is, to be less, you know, prescriptive about things, less judgmental, less, you don't expect things. You know, sometimes you're just going on a walk. And Guy always talks, he says it's walking for the soul. And it's nice to walk with a group of people with this sort of purpose. And the one that, that again, that we're doing, you really are in sight of Ely Cathedral for the kind, beautiful. And because it, yeah, but, and it's sort of Fenland. So you kind of think, oh God, you know, will this ever end? Going longer, but the cathedral's there and the cathedral's getting closer. And there's something about that, about something's in sight. So you do have a kind of a place you want to get to. And again, Emma Bridgewater is the one who's a proper practiced pilgrim. And when people say, oh, so is it just the journey, not the arrival? So no, it really is about the arrival, you know, so there's a point you get to. And when you get there, as she says, it's a kind of, it's a sort of lightening of the load in some way.
So what next?
I shall see. Is that, that's the thing. I have no plans. So I have a few things, as I said, I have some interesting boards, you know, the Science Museum and Bletchley Park and Channel 4 and but I think I will, once our walk is over, I will just see how things shape up. So I'm just not planning anything. I think that's the important thing. I mean, actually, Kit's late where I'm trying to... actually, that's what I'm doing now. My next thing.
Yes, tell us about Kit's Lake.
I am trying to get turtle doves. The point about Kit's Lake is that it has this view of the cathedral. So it's so the idea is if I could get turtle doves, you know, flying across the lake, symbol of peace, I think that would be... So I'm now signed up to a lot of turtle dove courses. I'm going to a turtle dove convention shortly.
Is there such a thing?
Yes, there is, in Cambridgeshire. I know. So all these things outside the swell of news are happening. So that is my next that's my next project, is turtle doves.
Sarah, that was just so interesting and wonderful. Thank you very, very much.
No, well, thank you so much.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Sarah Sands. If you've enjoyed listening to us and want to hear more conversations like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My thanks again to Sarah Sands for a fascinating conversation, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.